My name is Alan Abramson. I direct the Aspen Institute's program that focuses on the nonprofit sector and philanthropy, nonprofits being that third important sector of our society next to government and business. And I'm pleased to welcome you to this session on global development, the challenges of global development. My role is simply to introduce the moderator, Peter Reiling, who will carry the ball from there. Peter is has for several years served as the executive vice president of the Aspen Institute. He oversees our policy programs and leadership programs and has been a terrific developer of new leadership programs, which have now taken root in quite a few regions around the world. Peter, prior to coming to the Aspen Institute several years ago, Peter served as executive director of TechnoServe, a nonprofit that helps entrepreneurs to build businesses in low-income communities around the world. I realize that most of the discussion today will probably be about government assistance, but my selfish plug is that we at least have a little discussion about the role of philanthropy, too. I know that a lot of the folks we work with are interested to know how can they help in their private ways with some of the serious problems that people face around the world. Peter.
Thanks, Alan. So welcome to today's plenary session on the world economy called The Challenge of Development. We have a panel of five. We have an hour. We have a huge topic, and we have everybody in this room straining to get front row seats to see Bill Clinton, I know. So we're going to we're going to march along and dig right in. I do want to introduce our panelists, but with apologies in advance, I'm not going to go into your full bios of all of your college dissertations, if that's okay, Tim. Okay, so I'm going to start with Swami Iyer, former editor of India's two largest financial dailies, the Economic Times and Financial Express, as well as India correspondent for The Economist. Swami writes a weekly column for The Times of India called Swaminomics. He's an occasional consultant for the World Bank, where he and I just met a few weeks ago, and is currently serving as a research fellow at the Cato Institute. Swami, welcome. Seated next to Swami is Bill Easterly, MIT economist who spent 16 years at the World Bank before unleashing a book that brought he and I into the same orbit. One thing about Bill Easterly, when he writes a book, his title leaves no doubt about what he's really wanting to say to you. His first book was called The Elusive Quest for Growth, Economists' Adventures and Misadventures in the Tropics. And his more recent book is called The White Man's Burden, Why the West's Efforts to Aid the Rest Have Done So Much Ill and So Little Good. I'll let you guess what the books are about. Bill is a professor of economics at NYU and a visiting fellow at Brookings, among other places. Seated next to Bill is Arthur Mutambara, leading Zimbabwean opposition leader as well as CEO of Africa Technology and Business Institute based in South Africa, Rhodes Scholar, McKinsey consultant, NASA research scientist. The list is really quite amazing when you look at Arthur's background. I know him as an inaugural fellow of something called the Africa Leadership Initiative in South Africa, and Arthur and I have spent a lot of time in the hills of South Africa talking about legacy and the challenges of leadership, and he's very much stepped up to the plate. Tim Wirth hardly needs an introduction in these parts, exceptionally well known as congressman and senator from Colorado, and of course today he's known around the globe as the president of the United Nations Foundation and the Better World Fund, both founded in 1998. Through a major financial commitment from Ted Turner, a sometime participant right here in the Ideas Fest. Great to have you here. And to my right, Carol Lancaster, former deputy administrator of the U.S. Agency for International Development, associate professor of politics in the School of Foreign Service, my alma mater at Georgetown University. And she has a new book out called Foreign Aid, Diplomacy, Development, and Domestic Politics. So with those introductions underway, why don't we get going? Tim, on Tuesday I opened up my mailbox, my email box, and I had this email in there. It was an e-newsletter from the United Nations, and the headline is Developing Countries Make Strides Against Poverty and Child Mortality. The text reads, Developing countries are making clear progress towards lifting millions of people out of extreme poverty, the 2007 Millennium Development Goals report has found. Could you maybe just share with the group, first of all, what are the Millennium Development Goals? Because some people may not be familiar. And then tell us a bit about this report and the progress that is being made.
Here, let me just back up and say, first of all, we are a function of philanthropy, Ted Turner's philanthropy. You said, right. I hope there would be some discussion of that. Mr. Turner created the UN Foundation, and our job is to support the UN, to help to strengthen the UN, help to reform the UN. The UN is many, many things. We have to put the Millennium Development Goals in some context. The UN reaches into our lives in ways that most of us don't even think about. If you want to mail a letter from here to Cape Town, it gets from here to a mailbox there because of international agreements monitored by the UN. Airplanes land going in the same direction around the world because of those international agreements. UN has an enormous peacekeeping venture around the world, as you probably know, the largest force anywhere in the world outside the United States, 100,000 troops in some of the very toughest places in the world. SARS, bird flu, and so on, that's the World Health Organization. The UN reaches to a whole variety of activities which most of us really don't know much about. One of the singular missions of the UN, and always has been, in addition to its peacekeeping political mission, has been the development mission. What role can nations play coming together to try to better the lot, particularly of that almost 50% of the globe's population living in very, very poor circumstances? And the UN has a number of agencies and institutions designed to try to do this. It's a very difficult task, as we will get into. In 2000, the world came together, the political leadership of the world came together, the most remarkable gathering of political leaders, heads of state ever in the history of the world, came together in New York and agreed upon the Millennium Development Goals, the MDGs, Millennium Development Goals. There were seven related to child mortality, maternal mortality, AIDS, hunger, housing. There were seven basic Millennium Development Goals. And those were set, the purpose of which, in summary, was to try to set a global goal of having global poverty by 50% by the year 2015. That was the overall goal. And the UN, therefore, established not only goals for itself, but asked every country to come together and put together an economic plan, a political plan, to get that country on the way to achieving the Millennium Development Goals. Now, this is norm setting. This is the UN at its best. The UN operationally much less good than it is in terms of political norm setting. What should we be doing as a global people? What should we be doing together? That's the setting of norms, and these were a set of norms under the Millennium Development Goals. We're now halfway to this very, very ambitious task. And as pointed out, you know, this report has just come out. The best report every year probably comes out of the UN Development Program, UNDP. They do an annual report on poverty and development, and there's a measurement of this, and this report just came out, saying that, in fact, we were doing better than most people thought. In some areas, particularly in South Asia and East Asia, development has gone along very well, thank you very much, for a whole variety of reasons. In other parts of the world, particularly sub-Saharan Africa, the very poorest parts of the world, probably not. The results have not been anywhere near that, and in fact, it is probably in many ways, and others here know a lot more about this than I do, we've had less progress than more progress. Two final thoughts on this by way of introduction. Two items were not included in the deliberation of the Millennium Development Goals, in the development of them. One was the issue of population and women's reproductive health. It was too hot a topic for the political leadership of the world to bring together. And yet, we know that the world's population is still growing very rapidly. We're at 6.5 billion people. We're going to go to 9 billion people. Most of that growth is going to occur in the 50 poorest countries of the world, making the development challenge even more complicated and even more difficult. So there's another window on the whole development process that is politically very, very difficult, but extraordinarily important, related to population, reproductive health, the empowerment of women, and so on. And the second variable, and I'll stop with this, is one that we've been discussing here at Aspen all week long, and that's the climate issue. When the Millennium Development Goals were put together, and I think still among most political leadership at the UN, you mentioned climate change, and they sort of look at you and say, well, real men do development, real men do economics, you know, we don't do things like environment and climate change. That has now changed very, very significantly, and the new Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon, former South Korean foreign minister, has put a remarkable point on the climate change issue to make that central to everything that is happening at the UN. He has set three central priorities. One, the Middle East and working on that issue. Second, UN reform. And third, climate change. It's a very, very dramatic change from anything that has occurred in the past and will have a very significant bearing on any hopes for development and achieving the 2015 goal. And we're on the road to trying to do that.
Thanks, Tim. And if I'm not mistaken, when I turned on NPR this morning, I think I heard some tapes of your hearings in, was it 1986 on global warming?
Yeah, that was right. Yeah, that's right.
So it was fascinating.
You did the first one, so it was.
Bill Easterly, I know you have your thoughts about the Millennium Development Goals. What are they?
Well, these goals are great sounding things. They're one of the best sounding ideas to come along in a long time. Unfortunately, as public policy, they're one of the worst public policy instruments that I've seen in my career in economics. And why is this? It's because the UN forgot to say who exactly is responsible for achieving these goals. So the UN does, just as Tim said, they issue these dire reports year after year saying how Africa is failing to meet all of the goals, and yet nobody is held responsible for this failure. How meaningful is it to set a goal in which nobody is held responsible for doing anything? That's the unpleasant, dirty secret behind the goals. Behind all the noble-sounding rhetoric, nobody is actually accountable for doing anything. So, for example, the 2 million babies who died last year in Africa from diarrheal diseases for lack of 10-cent oral rehydration kits, nobody is held responsible for that. The 1 to 3 million who died from malaria for lack of bed nets and malaria medicines, no one's held responsible. It goes on and on. The list goes on and on for things that are easily achievable and preventable and yet happen anyway, and that's so tragic. It's because in the aid system is full of noble-sounding rhetoric but never holds anyone actually accountable for getting something done, and so things don't get done. And I'm afraid the UN Millennium Development Goals are one of the worst examples of that. Let me give you a specific illustration of this. One of the very noble goals is reducing maternal mortality. So, of course, who can disagree with that? Is there anyone here who's in favor of maternal mortality? Would like to see an increase in maternal mortality? So I think the UN has won that argument, that they've convinced all of us that it would be good to reduce maternal mortality, and certainly there's heartbreaking losses that are going on because maternal mortality is still so high. So they've set this goal of, you know, a quantitative reduction in maternal mortality. This variable is not even measured in most countries of the world. The UN has not bothered to invest in even collecting the statistic on how many mothers. This feedback always happens to me when I'm talking. The UN also thoughtfully contributed the sound system to this session. If something is not even measured, then obviously not only, you know, is no one held accountable, but we don't even know if the goal is going to be met or not because no one even bothered to measure the goal. That's how little seriousness there really is underlying this high-flown rhetoric about achieving the goals. I'd place a lot more confidence in the process of global economic growth that is lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty through the homegrown private entrepreneurs and democratic reformers like my colleague sitting next to me here. That's what's achieving progress around the world, not UN rhetoric.
We've had conversations about foreign aid over the years, and you've said to me recently you think foreign aid gets a bad rap. Why do you say that?
Well, Bill is the main reason. I think I could I just disagree with Bill on the Millennium Development Goals?
No.
I can't let this go unanswered. I always disagree with Bill, so we're getting into a little pattern here.
Well, we didn't see you next week, so
well, I like Bill. He's a nice guy. Just has the wrong ideas. Yes, the Millennium Development Goals are a lot of rhetoric, and nobody is held accountable because it's very hard to hold all those people accountable who are, in fact, able to do something about the issue in an international setting. Tim Worth can talk more about that, but, you know, who is accountable? Who is responsible? Families are responsible. Communities are responsible. National governments are responsible, and the international community probably should be held somewhat responsible because it can help. We're all rich. We're beyond blessed in this country and in many rich countries, and we can spare and do spare some of our resources to help. And I think it's important to have goals and rhetoric, because rhetoric inspires. And I don't know about you, but I need inspiration. That's why I come to the Ideas Festival, partly. And I think that's important. They also hold us to a standard that we can go back and talk about and do as much as we can about accountability. So let's just leave it there, and others will probably have other things to say. On foreign aid. Foreign aid, among many, gets a bad rap, in this country in particular. I think there's a very fundamental reason for that. That is because this country was conceived, as no other country was, in an era of classical liberalism. I think we are, in many ways, and have been, sort of libertarians in our heads, much more than any other rich country in the world that I'm aware of. If you look at Europe, there's a social democratic tradition there. We are much more individualistic. And I think that involves relationship of government to society, which has been contentious and continues to be contentious in this country. And all debate about health care is partly debate about the role of government in society. Foreign aid gets mixed up in that. And the very first time the United States proposed, it was proposed in Congress, to provide foreign aid, which was, you won't believe this, 1794, not 1974, 1794, it was proposed to give some aid to some destitute French refugees from the slave revolt in Santo Domingo. They were starving in Baltimore. And James Madison, a member of Congress at that time, said, "Not on your life. This is not an appropriate use of public funds, and it is prohibited, or at least it is not permitted in the Constitution." That debate took place all through the 19th century, and even into the 20th century after the Second World War. We don't talk that way any longer, except perhaps the Cato Institute, and I think they may have even shifted over a little bit. I'm just joking. But there is still an inherent skepticism. And I think that has generated, on the side of the advocates, perhaps an overselling of foreign aid. Foreign aid, when you use it for development, is an intervention in another society. It's very hard to get it right. We try, we make mistakes, we get it right sometimes. I think it's done a great deal of good, in contrast perhaps to Bill's views. I think probably hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people are alive today because some of the things that aid has financed. And I don't only say public aid. I'm talking about philanthropy and private giving, which has become so important. And not just private giving, but now the entry of enterprises into this whole area. I think it's been very exciting to see what's happened in the last 5 or 10 years. But you can think of things like the Green Revolution, much of the family planning, things that involve the creation of healthcare systems, HIV/AIDS, education, and so on. You know, the private sector is the engine. We all recognize that. But the private sector isn't going to do very much if people are ill and if people are uneducated and if there's no infrastructure. So there's a role for it. It has to be used carefully. One other point, and I'll stop. We should always bear in mind when we criticize foreign aid, particularly U.S. foreign aid, that we don't always use it for development. A great deal of our aid is used for what in the older days was called the Cold War containment policy, and today is called GWAT. Does anybody know what GWAT is? That's the Global War on Terror. Come to Washington. We have any number of acronyms for you, and that is one of them. And I think we're beginning to see a move towards shifting our aid focus, I hope not too much away from development, towards fighting the global war on terror. And the emphasis there is increasingly on something called failed and failing states. And it is becoming a program not just provided by the traditional aid agencies, but also by the Defense Department. Last year, the Defense Department provided 20% of our economic assistance, not military assistance. So there's stuff going on out there, and we should be aware that when we complain about foreign aid, we may be complaining about something that was used for diplomatic purposes as a primary goal and not development, and it's unfair to judge it for what it was not primarily driven for.
Arthur, I'm going to come to you in a minute, okay, about this concept of outsiders coming into a country with foreign aid and trying to create change, but I'm going to jump to Swami for a second, okay? Swami, you and I met about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago in Washington, and I asked you about your view on foreign aid. You have some very pointed views about foreign aid. You feel it doesn't work particularly well, and you have some thoughts about how foreign aid could be improved. What would be an ideal foreign aid system? Would you care to talk
okay,
about that?
No, well, let me put it this way. Mm-hmm. And on this, I'd be to the left of Cato. Foreign aid is like a drug. In small quantities, it is a stimulant. It can be a medicine. It can rectify various ills. In large quantities, it is a drug. It creates junkies. It creates addicts. This distinction, I find, is not made in common discourse, though it is evident if you just look at the world. Now, okay, the same guy who doesn't like you doesn't like me. Yeah. So I find that there is this business of trying to set an aid target for rich countries as though the issue is one of giving. Please, as more and more of us stop depending on foreign aid, it would really mean that if you give 0.7% of rich countries aid, it will soon become 100% of the GDP of African countries. I mean, that is not the way to go. I am very clear that instead of setting a target for rich countries, there should be a target for poor countries. I would get uncomfortable if more than 5% of the GDP of a developing country is aid, and if it's 10%, I would say, absolutely, you must stop. Let me mention that in my own country, India's aid had become zero or negative in 2000. It has gone up to about $1 billion today, which may look large. Actually, it works out to 0.1% of GDP. So I'm not against foreign aid. You can increase India's aid 10 times. It would still only be 1% of GDP, and I'm quite happy with that. What I want to emphasize is that, therefore, even if you doubled aid to India 10 times, Indian development would be done by Indians, by us, according to our priorities. With 1% coming in from abroad, it could not be dictated by a large number of golden-hearted people from abroad who often mess up. My real problem is when I come across, I mean, in the World Bank, I heard about there are so many donors doing so many programs in Tanzania that the bureaucracy, the civil service was spending all its time just listening to and meeting foreign missions. And they declared, we now are going to have one mission-free quarter a year where we don't receive any foreign missions so that we can actually listen to our own citizens. I mean, I find that a disgraceful state of affairs. Okay, how do we overcome this? Apart from having the ceiling on aid, I would say we need to have an idea that where apparently states are not making good use of foreign aid, why give it to governments? I mean, my own government in India is full of thugs and criminals. A cabinet minister recently had to step down when the courts determined that he had murdered his private secretary who had demanded a splitting of a bribe. So, I mean, when we have these thugs in my own democracy, in my own country, you can imagine what the state of affairs is in a large number of other countries. So all I can say is, if you find that aid to a certain number of thuggish guys is benefiting a rich elite and not the people, surely you should say, stop giving aid directly to governments, give it directly to the people. There are transactions costs in getting money down to individuals.
Is it possible
but,
to do?
Okay. First place, if you want to get down to communities, in many places, if you organize, it is feasible. With the cell phone revolution that is coming, and where you can open individual virtual accounts in a cell phone with biometric identification, if you ask me, you can even get it down to the individual level. But I would say at least let's start. And I would say right now, if a state fails, you know, I understand Carol Lancaster saying, I can't abandon that country. I can't say, you know, okay, because it has a thuggish ruler, I give no money to that country. But I would say you progressively move aid away from the government, shift more and more to the communities. When the dictator or the thug discovers that if he doesn't improve his governance, he's losing his money, he finally has an incentive to improve his governance, which I'm afraid currently he does not.
Okay.
So, I mean, this is just a few suggestions for reform. There are many more, but I don't have time to give them all.
We'll look for your next column. Arthur, what about this whole idea? I know there's something else you want to talk about. We'll get to that. But what do you think about this idea of foreign aid,
outside aid coming into a country and trying to create change.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. The most important thing to say is that the countries that are failing, the African countries that are failing, must take responsibility for their own actions. In other words, we are sick and tired of scapegoating. So we're guilty as charged. There's been a failure of leadership in Africa. There's been a failure of vision, but we're doing something about it. Now, you can't discuss foreign aid when you don't even know what we want. What do we want? What are our challenges in Africa? Number one, building strong institutions, developing value systems that will bring about sustainable development. That's our number one challenge. Number two, we don't want aid. We want economic investment. We want manufacturing. We want to make sure that we refine our products in Africa and not churn out raw materials. Our challenge is how do we build our own local industries? How do we promote manufacturing without being protectionist? How do we do that without going against the market? How do we convince our friends in America that we don't want to be receiving aid and donations forever? We want to become your competitors. We want to be producing computers, cameras, and selling them to America. That's what we want. Number three, we want shared growth. The tragedy has been where we've had some development, the growth is not shared. There are serious inequalities in our societies. How can we bring about shared economic growth in Africa? Number four, the bottom of the pyramid, Parahaladi, Professor Parahaladi. You can't apply the same methodology of development that you have in Australia, in Japan, in America, in Africa, because we are talking about people in Africa who are at the bottom of the pyramid. You need new economic models to unlock value at the bottom of the pyramid. We are grappling with building those economic models at the bottom of the pyramid. Number five, regional integration. We're busy building SADC, ECOWAS, ECA, AU. How do you bring about regional integration and still respect national sovereignty? How do we move from national sovereignty to regional sovereignty? How do we move towards global sovereignty? These are some of the challenges we're grappling with. And also we are saying science and technology. How can we leverage science and technology to drive our economies? We are saying we have a unique opportunity to run where you walked, to leapfrog from the 19th century where our economies are to the digital economy by using clean fuels, clean technologies, wireless power, wireless telecoms, biotechnology, clean fuels. We have a unique opportunity because of our poverty to actually leapfrog and do better than the West. That's what we want. So as you discuss aid, as you discuss donations, please contextualize it within our desires. So the tragedy has been people have not taken time to understand what we need in Africa and what we're trying to do. So emphasis must be put on economic development. We are saying, how can we have economic development through profits? Come to Africa and invest and make money, but also provide jobs, also provide economic growth. Building an economy on donations and aid is not sustainable. HIV/AIDS. Human rights. We are saying that global challenges we're grappling with, nuclear weapons, human rights, HIV/AIDS, climate change, technology, are interconnected. You can't resolve the challenges of climate change without attacking HIV/AIDS in Africa. You can't address the issue of growth and development in America without addressing the ghettos of America. One third of young black males are in prison or prison, parole, or probation in America. The ghettos of America are suffering. So we are saying let's have collective victory, success in America, which is inclusive, success in the world, which is inclusive. Please understand us before you help us help ourselves.
So, Arthur, I'd like to follow up on that. We Swami hinted in the fact that we all know, and certainly this comes out in the Millennium Development Goals, that we have seen growth, we have seen successes. But when we disaggregate, we know a lot of the growth in the numbers of people moving above $2 a day has been in places like India and China, where the economies have been growing, and that's where we've seen the greatest impact. We know that in Africa, things are still moving quite slowly. You've just laid out a great prescription. How do we move from ideas to those actual actions? And then, Bill, I want you to talk a bit about how we're, in fact, evaluating Africa, because we had a discussion about that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the starting point is the Africans must take responsibility for their own actions. No whining and crybabies in Africa. So once we have stepped up to the plate, as we have done, then we say, how can America help us build institutions, a new people-driven democratic constitution in Zimbabwe, new electoral laws that provide for free and fair elections? How do you develop a value system that respects constitutions? Let me emphasize that point. In America, you take it for granted. When Bill Clinton left in the year 2000, he was more popular than Gore and Bush put together. But none of you ever proposed to change the constitution to have Bill Clinton continue for another 8 years. In other words, we have a value system that respects constitutions. In Africa, we've had term limits. In Nigeria, in Malawi, and in Zambia, term limits. And when the time to go came, Obasanjo wanted to change to have a third term. Muluzi wanted to have a third term. And Chiluba wanted to do the same thing. So we need assistance in building constitutions, strong institutions, and developing value systems. Then ask yourselves, why are you not, as an investor, I'm sure you're investing in China, you're investing in India, and making maybe 20% profits, 30% profits. Why can't you come to Africa and maybe make 10% profit or 5% profit, which is still profit, but you are also assisting us in creating jobs and growing our infrastructure, growing our economies? Those are some of the things you can do as a government and as individual corporate people. And let me challenge my African-American brothers, Oprah Winfrey, Colin Powell, Michael Jordan. Where are you investing your money? If you have $50 million, Oprah Winfrey, and maybe you're investing it in America and making 20%, why can't you come to Africa and make 5%? Why? Because you are an African, you came from Africa. We need to identify with our countries of origin. The Jews do the same thing with Israel. The Indians do the same thing with India. And the Chinese do the same. The Africans are a travesty of justice.
Bill? Bill, we talked about this idea that Africa is somehow lagging behind, and you had what I call an allergic reaction to that idea. Tell me about it.
Well, first of all, Arthur is a very hard act to follow. I would just like to hear him talk more, really. But, you know, things, there's a lot of media sources, and these days, you know, well-known public policy figures like Angelina Jolie and Bono, who are peddling images of Africa as kind of an unrelieved disaster zone. And this is, you know, really not, and even the UN, I think, in its Millennium Development Goals campaign seems to want to make Africa look worse than it is. Let me give you a couple of examples. One of the Millennium Development Goals is universal primary education by the year 2015. Well, you know, Africa was the poorest region, and so it started off with the lowest percentage of children enrolled in elementary school when these goals were set. So it had the farthest distance to go. So it was these Millennium Development Goals, if Africa fails to meet them, it was being asked to meet a much more difficult challenge than all the other regions. And so the UN is calling Africa's efforts on education a failure. Well, in fact, let me... There goes our... Why does this only happen when Swami and I are talking, huh? In fact, Africa has expanded education at twice the rate that Western countries did when they were at the same level of income. And many African countries are expanding education more rapidly than all other developing countries. So I would call that a success. It just doesn't happen to fit into this artificial UN definition that you have to have universal primary enrollment by 2015. It's very rapid, but it would take historically unprecedented rates of educational expansion to meet that goal. Why is Africa required to do that and no other region is? That's really being unfair to Africa, and it peddles this negative stereotype of Africa, which is not justified. And I think there's an incentive that people have to perpetuate these negative stereotypes, because then it creates more demand for fundraising, for helping the allegedly, you know, passive, helpless African continent overcome its difficulties, when in fact the African continent has had three straight years of 6% GDP growth. I don't know what's so disappointing about that. It's had the last 5 years has been the best 5 years of growth in its history. It got $38 billion in private capital last year, which is more than foreign aid to Africa. Cell phone and internet use have doubled every year for the past 7 years, thanks to private entrepreneurs like Arthur. You know, there are a lot of good things that are happening in Africa that are happening from the efforts of Africans themselves. So let's start giving Africa a break, recognize the achievements that Africans are already making, and not keep insisting on these negative disaster stereotypes that are only good for the tabloids. Please.
So we've talked about foreign aid flows, official flows, right? And Arthur's talked about the role of the business community, bringing investment to Africa. What about private philanthropy? Tim, want to talk about the role of private philanthropy and what it could be doing?
Let me just give you, if it'd be useful to just give a few examples. We, for the most part, try to stay away from this abstract debate. You know, it doesn't get us very far, and you hear it all the time, and people get all excited by it, but sort of say, okay, what can we really get done? Let me just give you a few examples of, you know, what private philanthropy can do. We have a budget of about $280 million a year. $50 million comes from Mr. Turner. $230 million comes from a whole lot of other partners working on this. Let me give you a few examples. One, there are currently in the world today 200 million couples who would like to use family planning but don't have any access to family planning, and there is a massive condom shortfall in the world. We are involved with that distribution issue, with the manufacturing issue, with the availability of condoms in that sense, and working very hard to lobby Capitol Hill to continue to support U.S. as the largest manufacturer and contributor. Now, that's an area that focuses on reproductive health, making those available. If African or other health ministers want to take advantage of it, fine. Malaria. The single most important thing to be done is the availability of bed nets. We got together with Sumitomo, developed a manufacturing center in Tanzania for the development of DDT impregnated bed nets that last for a five-year period of time. Sumitomo's technology, some of our funding, and the UN blessing to get this to happen. We're in the process of helping to train the African diplomats who have to be involved in the climate discussions. These are incredibly complicated, incredibly difficult, and here are countries with no expertise whatsoever. We're providing the help and the expertise, you know, to them. And if they want to take advantage of it, that's fine, but they're going to have to become part and parcel of this. We do a lot of public affairs to try to explain to people the fact that, for example, UN humanitarian missions are feeding hundreds of thousands of people in Darfur. And if it weren't for that, as Carol pointed out, there would be hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people starving. And that's where U.S. taxpayer dollars, we pay about 25% of that tab, what we're doing and how that's effective. We have picked out a variety of very particular areas where we think that the addition of our private money, working with UN agencies, you know, who have, again, the moral suasion, they have the credibility and so on, setting a particular goal, looking at that in the context, and then trying to move that along. Now, does this work every time? Of course it doesn't, Bill. The UN is not an agency that goes out enforcing what a country does or doesn't do. If a country wants to pick that up, if that healthcare agency wants to become engaged in the distribution of malaria bed nets, we'll help that to happen. But if they don't want to do it, that's their choice. You know, in reproductive health issues. If a country, you know, is very interested in encouraging reproductive health as part of the national health care program, and many, many agencies are not interested in doing that, but if they are, you know, we think that that's very important and we want to help to encourage that. While we're doing this, we also have, we spend about 30% of our money, you know, lobbying and working with the United States Congress and with the European Union. Why did Willie Sutton rob banks? Because that's where the money is. Why do we lobby the Congress? Why do we go to Brussels? Because that's where the money is. And trying to get them, you know, to increase their support for this. So that's the way, one, we've learned a lot of lessons. We wasted a lot of money, I'm sure, along the way. We've learned a lot of lessons. We're as targeted as we can possibly be on a few issues that we think we can make a difference. And, you know, if people want to pick that up, fine. And if they don't, anyway, that we've done the best we can.
Thanks. Arthur, you touched on the issue of leadership and the need for strong, credible, values-based leadership in Africa. We need it everywhere, so let's be clear. But you talked about foreign investors coming in and investing in Africa, maybe accepting a lower rate of return if they're willing to do that. But we heard from Tom Friedman the other day, he's talking about his new book now, but in his former books he talks about the electronic herd, right? That is very skittish, and it hears stories of Zimbabwe, it hears stories of Nigeria, and it is skittish and says, we're not so sure we're going to put our money there. What's it going to take to get the sort of leadership that will make foreign investment more comfortable in Africa?
Let me start by saying that when you say that it's risky, I'm not sure whether I'm going to put my money there. The problem is some of the risk models we use, one of the major inputs into those models is ignorance. In other words, we need to make sure there's enough awareness and knowledge about Africa so that the perception of gloom, the perception of unprofitability is removed. I'll give an example of a company in South Africa called MTN. During the cell phone boom, people were very worried about Nigeria. Oh, Nigerians are crooks. Oh, if I put money into Nigeria. MTN did the analysis properly. And they went into Nigeria. Right now, MTN makes more money from Nigeria than they make from South Africa. And the same can be said of many other corporations who did the proper risk analysis and moved into those countries. So the starting point is, it's not as bad as people think it is. Yes, there's risk. What you need to do is to understand the nature of the risk and come up with risk mitigation measures and get in there and invest. When I say you get a lower percentage level of profit, I'm just being conservative. You could actually make more profit in Africa than you make elsewhere. Why? Let's think about global outsourcing. What are the key drivers of global outsourcing? Time zones, so that you can have 24-hour service without night shifts. Two, cost differentials, cheap labor and cheap raw materials. And then number three, quality. On those three, we can do better than India, Africa. We can do better than China, Africa. So why are corporations outsourcing in China and India and not Africa? Why? I'm saying our labor is cheaper than China and India. Our raw materials are cheaper than China and India. And two, the time zones, we have them. And number three, quality, human capital. Our human capital in Zimbabwe, for example, is better than, I think it's in the top five in the world. Our educational systems have produced skilled people who can produce, who can actually work. So which means, for example, in outsourcing, there's potential for companies to globally outsource to Africa and make a better profit than India and China. However, it's not enough. We need to do more to make it attractive. What will it take to do that? Nothing comes cheap. We have to grow leadership. We have to build leadership in Africa. So that's why the programs, the Ali program, the Aspen Institute, has been very instrumental in developing and assisting in the technocratic capacity building in Africa. So that we have leaders who have a vision, an economic vision. Leaders who have an economic strategy to take us from poverty to the promised land. So it will require actually philanthropy. Why don't you invest some of this private philanthropy in building leaders in Africa, in building answers? One thing that we've had in Africa is what we call the cycle of poverty, the cycle of death. You have a democratic change, and then you go back to dictatorship. Democratic change, dictatorship. Look at Malawi. Banda brought independence to Malawi. He became a dictator. Was taken out through democracy by Muluzi. Muluzi became a dictator. Zambia, Kaunda brought independence. Kaunda becomes a dictator. He's taken out through a democratic process by Chiluba. Chiluba becomes a dictator. We're sick and tired of that in Africa. In Zimbabwe, for example, when our change comes, we want to make sure that change has both form and substance, which means you must build institutions to protect Zimbabweans from me. Never depend on personalities. Depend on strong institutions. Depend on value systems so that Zimbabwe can become a globally competitive economy in terms of GDP, per capita income, entrepreneurship, and shared growth. So we have a long way to go. But the good thing is that we're doing something about our circumstances. But we need help in terms of capacity building, creating solutions, land policy, social policy, HIV/AIDS. This one, this is where the human society should be ashamed of itself. In Zimbabwe, every week, 4,000 people are dying because of HIV/AIDS compounded by malnutrition. Yeah? And we're talking about a life expectancy of 35 years, 85% unemployment in the country, 90% poverty levels in the country. You can't feel content as Americans, as Europeans, when humanity is being decimated by HIV/AIDS. So we want to see leadership in Africa and leadership globally to make sure that Africa becomes an attractive place. But we are seeking holistic and unified solutions that say that we must address climate change, we must address HIV/AIDS, malaria, at the same time talk about economic activities, economic investment in our country.
Go to questions from the audience, and if anyone has questions, there's two mics. But I want to ask a question, last question, of the, and I'll open it up to the group. You can't have a gathering like the Ideas Fest and not talk about China. We spent a lot of time talking about China. I was in Ghana a little over a month ago with a group of business leaders from both Ghana and Nigeria, and they said China is the best thing to happen to Africa in a long time. There's aid coming in, very little strings attached to it. There's investment coming in. It's a huge boost for the economy. Do you view China as opportunity, threat? Carol?
Yeah, I was just in China about 2 weeks ago. I bought this shirt. It says dragon on it, I think. So I particularly like it. I don't know if it's me or China that I like about it. But anyway, I think China is creating a presence in Africa that's very significant. That's part of their diplomatic goals. They had a huge conference in Beijing last November, where they brought, I think, the heads of 52 African states to China. There were a lot of commitments made. I think it can be very advantageous for Africa because it provides extra resources. The Chinese are doing things that others are not so eager to do. They're building infrastructure when others are not so eager. They're doing business investment. They're opening up mineral resources. And they're giving the Africans a little political and economic space. They think that Africa's on the verge of a major economic expansion. However, there are also big risks and problems. There's been whether you like it or not, there's been a lot of international cooperation to try to persuade the Africans to do just what Arthur was saying, to create more responsible and accountable political institutions, improve human rights, and take care of the environment. The Chinese are really not interested in that, or haven't been up until recently. And so they come in and open up the possibility that Africans can say, we don't accept your pressures. We're not really interested. It actually happened in Angola at one point. So that's the kind of a thing that people are concerned about. We see it a little bit in Sudan, where the Chinese have been a major support for the Sudanese government, and therefore, by implication, people have attributed some of the Darfur problems to the Chinese. I think the Chinese are actually getting quite sensitive to this. They've actually appointed their own envoy to look at the Darfur issue and have begun putting a little pressure on the Sudanese government. And similar relationship with Zimbabwe, the government there. They also bring in their own laborers to do their infrastructure projects and other projects, and that has caused a lot of criticism. Why can't you use African labor? The Chinese are moving into a space with a lot of energy, a lot of opportunity, and bringing with it a lot of challenges. And I think the challenge for us is to try to engage the Chinese, not confront them, but engage them in a broader dialogue and set of activities that will help them embrace more than they have some of the international norms. They know they have a problem. I was just there and talking to people about their aid, and one of the things they said is, we're not sure how this should be organized. We're rethinking it. We're going to perhaps have an announcement at the 17th Party Congress in October on how we ought to do this. So I think they're open to dialogue, and I think that's the opportunity that confronts us and also the Africans.
Let's go to some audience questions, if we could.
Yes.
Can I just react very briefly?
Okay, and then I want to get some questions.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Chinese have learned from the master. They have learned from the Americans. America does not have permanent friends. It has permanent interests. To hell with human rights and democracy. You can't accuse the Chinese of going to Darfur and getting oil from Sudan in spite of the human rights violation when ourselves as America, we are doing business with Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, who are no Democrats. What moral authority do we have to even discuss China in Darfur when we don't discuss America in Kuwait and Saudi Arabia? What I'm saying is, I'm not endorsing China. I'm saying that for you to make sense to the Chinese, you must walk the talk. However, However, I think we need to also be active and get into Africa the way China is getting in there. If you don't get involved when people are in trouble, dubious characters will come in there and do activities. Look at our independence, our war of independence when we're oppressed. We were helped by Gaddafi in Libya. We were helped by Castro in Cuba. We were helped by the Russians, Stalin. There will be no Mandela without Stalin, for your information. There will be no Mandela without Castro. Why? Because when Mandela and them were fighting for freedom, the Americans were backing apartheid through constructive engagement. That's why when Mandela came from prison and came to America, he said, I want to go and visit my friend called Castro. The Americans were livid. He said, go to hell. When I was a terrorist for 27 years, Castro was my friend.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. I find this discussion, is this on?
Yes.
Very interesting, but very limited. As someone who works with African partners in an advocacy capacity on developing their health systems, this discussion is at an abstract level. We're saying, is Africa a basket case? Is Africa developing? Should there be aid? Should there be private investment? Those are false choices. And those false choices have consequences, like denigrating the efforts of people like Bono to raise money. There are real choices to be made and difficult choices in aid. For example, we need to distinguish between support for development of health systems and support for economic growth. Those are very different kinds of aid, and they have to be considered differently. Where if serious problems in health systems, for example, we have vertical programs like AIDS, malaria, we're not developing with African governments the ability to have sustainable health systems. We have to work with African civil society organizations so African governments make commitments. But I don't think it is helpful to have aid, no aid, economic development versus aid. There are many things that can be done with aid if it's
okay.
done in a sensible way.
Do you have a question for the group, please?
I'd just like to have a reaction to that about whether the discussion is taking place at the wrong level.
We, and I will say we have an hour for a pretty broad discussion. We could have put together a four-day ideas fest, I think, on the challenge of development. But if there's any reaction, please go ahead. Bill?
Well, I think it's worth it having this discussion because that's the way the West has phrased it in terms of African development. That, you know, the West, as has been pointed out a couple of times here, the West is taking all of the time of African governments and political leaders with bureaucratic requirements to fill out documents for aid projects. And that's so that, you know, a lot of despotic rulers are actually being propped up by aid, and African rulers are more accountable to aid agencies than they are to their own people. So in that sense, aid does need to be talked about as a big issue. And by the way, in response to Carol, this sort of aid skepticism versus sympathy for aid, this is not an ideological issue. This is based on the evidence. The evidence is that the whole big plan approach to come in with a crash aid finance program and develop a country has not worked. We have $568 billion of aid to Africa and zero growth to show us that has not worked. And we need to recognize that and shift to some other model. And it's high time that we did that and let people like Arthur run the show instead of letting Western donors run the show.
I want to move to another question because I do want to give people a chance. Yeah, I can't see
yes,
over there.
My name is Janet Benchoff, and I have one comment and one question for Mr. Wirth. My comment, first of all, is that I find it rather incredible sitting here for over an hour and not hearing the word woman once. Even though they're the majority of the population in Africa, they have the most advanced regional human rights treaty for women in the entire world, the African Protocol, and the highest courts in various countries in Africa have set some global precedents by saying that CEDAW and human rights treaties will overturn, for example, rape laws. So I think one of the greatest resources in Africa, and we look at Ellen Sirleaf Johnson, and she increases confidence in the country, are women, and that has not been mentioned as a source of development. Second, the United States in 1974 passed the Helms Amendment, which not only forbid aid from funding abortions, but any discussion of abortion with our foreign assistance funds. Now let's put that to the side. What that means, though, is that because the Foreign Assistance Act funds the UN. The UN, every single agency, censors itself down to the US level. So if there's 20 donors to UNFPA, they all get censored. And I did an analysis. Hundreds of millions of dollars are censored on discussing even law reform. And my question for Mr. Wirth is, for example, in 1990, Albania legalized abortion. 1995, maternal mortality in half. Is that reported by any UN agency? No. The country of Colombia legalized abortion through its court system last year. Was that reported?
Can we get to the question?
My question is, why is no politician and no UN agency protesting the speech limitations in the Helms Amendment, because they so relate to the Millennium Goals, to democracy, and to maternal mortality?
Thanks.
When I would say I agree entirely with you about the importance of empowering and the role of women and the kind of change that we've been talking about. I think, one, you weren't listening very carefully to the opening comments in which I described that related to the Millennium Development Goals and was very specific about what we do at the United Nations Foundation, nor do I think your facts about what the UN does related to women and abortion are accurate. There is a prohibition in the law, the Helms Amendment, which states very clearly that no U.S. money will go for the support of abortion. That's the law. And so the U.S. obeys that law. Now, when the time comes that maybe that law gets changed, it gets changed. But right now, that is the law. That law does not apply to the United Nations. The law that applies to the U.S. relationship to the United Nations is U.S. support for UNFPA, the UN Family Planning Organization. The UN Family Planning Organization is, under this administration, precluded from receiving any money from the U.S. because this administration has argued the UNFPA supports abortion and therefore the U.S. will not support it. Anyway, that is this administration's interpretation of the law. If the Democrats are elected in 2009, on January 21st, 2009, I will guarantee you that one of the first five things that change is that interpretation of the law, and the U.S. will once again become an interpreter and a supporter of UNFPA. Now, there is a major focus at the UN on the empowerment of women, on women's reproductive health issues. That is always difficult to do. That is politically a very difficult issue. As I pointed out, that is not women's reproductive health is not one of the Millennium Development Goals. It should be. You know, for various political reasons, it was not included. Maybe at some point it will be, but there is a lot of effort going on, particularly from some of the fine leadership in the UN, particularly Thuraya Obaid, who's the head of UNFPA, a Saudi woman, a Saudi PhD, the first woman to receive a PhD in Saudi Arabia, is the head of the UN Family Planning Organization and is doing, in my opinion, quite remarkable job internally within the UN in terms of advocacy on behalf of women and on behalf of women's reproductive health.
Thank you. We got time for one more question, unfortunately, only because we're going to finish up on time at 1:30. Please.
Many thanks. My name is Panchen Dabele, and I live and work in Southern Africa. Many thanks for the panel around your discussions. I have one comment. It's not all bleak in Africa. As a young African man working out in Africa trying to mobilize our own youth, we have a program that we're working on that's called Stand Up Africa. It's actually about getting and giving our own young 18 to 35-year-olds the spirit to do it for themselves. I think what's happening is that engagement is happening at the wrong levels. You still go to the same levels of government to try and actually make a difference on the ground, and we'll never get there. In the work that we're doing, we're working with the likes of MTV to actually reach to the young people. However, my question is this. The Millennium Development Goals offers an inspiration to actually try and change certain things on the ground. And neither did I hear any mention about the role of the private sector in actually playing a role in unlocking those very opportunities. Because there's no way governments are going to do it. It's about the private sector and civil society actually working together to unlock those very opportunities. Is there a role for the private sector to deliver on the MDGs?
Who wants to take that one? Arthur.
Yep, I totally agree with you, with the brother. It's very important that the private sector takes a central role in economic development. So the MDGs, he will speak to the MDGs directly, must somehow engage and involve the private sector. And in particular, in that private sector, there must be space for women. Gender justice is so critical in development. Women are running families. They're looking after HIV orphans. They're the bedrock of African economies. So our economic activities in the private sector must specifically also target women. Our philanthropy and aid must also target communities of women so that we can actually make a difference and make them succeed. It's not a question of either or. No one has ever said that. We need aid, we need economic development. The danger is some people are so fond of donations and aid, and they don't want to discuss economic investment, economic activity in Africa. We are saying we want both, but more importantly, in the long run, it's economic activity that will make us survive as Africans.
Amen. Thank you very much. Thank you.